Welcome back to TechNet Radio. Kevin Remedy and Brad Anderson are back for part two of their What's New in 2012 R2 series as they discuss the new and exciting Cloud OS vision and the next wave of Microsoft Server and System Center products. Tune in as they take a deep dive into how your business can transform its data center by harnessing the power of a hybrid cloud IT environment. Kevin, the mic is yours.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the second of our very special three-part series of discussions entitled What's New in 2012 R2, where we discuss the exciting new Cloud OS vision in the next wave of Microsoft Server and System Center products with Microsoft Corporate Vice President Brad Anderson. My name is Kevin Remedy, and I'm a Senior Technology Evangelist on the U.S. Developer and Platform Evangelism team at Microsoft, and I'm your TechNet Radio host today. Now, as mentioned, my special guest is Mr. Brad Anderson. Welcome, Brad.
Hey, thanks, Kevin. I don't know, Mr. Brad Anderson seems a little formal.
when I talk to a corporate vice president at Microsoft, I say Mr. That's just my way. And it's been a couple of weeks since we talked last, so why don't you just start out by reminding us what it is that a corporate VP of program management does at Microsoft?
Okay, sure. You know, I think many here would kind of say corporate VPs are probably, you know, so senior they don't know what's going on in the teams anymore. But no, honestly, what I do for a living here and what the program management function at Microsoft does is really the best way to think about it is we define what it is we're gonna build. You know, as you think about what the role of any leader in any kind of an organization has to deal with, you've got so many different pieces of information, so much telemetry. So many things coming in that is vying for time and vying for, you know, work to be done. And so what we do from a program management standpoint is we take all the different pieces of information coming in, whether that's, hey, what are the key trends? What are the customer enhanced requests coming in? What's competitors doing? Take all that, put it together and kind of say, here is what the strategy is for the company. Here are the features, here are the scenarios, here are the capabilities that we want to go do and want to go build, and here's how we want to actually go express those. We define that, we write the specs, and then we work with the rest of the engineering organization, you know, the developers and the developers in test, and then actually go build it. And so we you know, our role is really defining the strategy and defining what it is we're going to go build.
Fantastic, and I'm seeing the results of that work. Certainly many of us are coming through in the work, not only in working with the previews that have come out with Server 2012 and System Center 2012 R2, both versions, and other products that are along that wave, but also in the information that you've been putting out on your blog recently. It's been excellent to follow along this nine-part series. The second of the three pillars really was what we're going to talk about today, which has to do with transforming the data center. So first of all, thank you for all that great content, and certainly looking forward to the remaining parts as they come out. But let's talk about transforming the data center. What does that mean at a high level?
Yeah, so, you know, the key trend that we were, you know, tackling in this promise of transform the data center was the trend of the move to the cloud. You know, so just to kind of give a quick refresher, as we think about the key trends that are happening in the industry that we think are going to be the trends that will advance and differentiate organizations, we think that those trends are the move to the cloud, the explosion of data, the consumerization of IT, and then the new application development models. And we think that those are the core things that we believe we need to invest in to help advance organizations and help advance their businesses. And so this trend around the move to the cloud, and when I say move to the cloud, that's not, you know, just public cloud. Cloud computing is a computing model, it's not a location. So organizations are moving to cloud computing models running in their data centers, you know, utilizing capacity comes from service providers as well as from the public cloud. And so how do we help organizations embrace this trend? How do we help them, you know, get to the economics and, more importantly, the dynamic aspect that cloud computing builds and how that helps to advance the agility of organizations? And so one of these promises of the Microsoft Cloud OS is to help organizations transform their data center. And really, the key aspect of transforming the data center is how do you move into a cloud computing model, with most organizations, you know, 90% plus moving into a model where they will be using cloud capacity from multiple providers, so a hybrid cloud. And that's what we're talking about.
Okay. Now, in a recent blog post, you mentioned, and we're going to talk a little bit about open source software support, and I think that's really interesting because, you know, Microsoft forever has been a product or a company that supports our products, and maybe I've taken a bad rap in the past for not necessarily opening up to other technologies, other areas. But you mentioned something called the CEC, the Common Engineering Criteria. Could you give us a brief definition of what that's about and why that's so important for Microsoft when we're building products for businesses?
Yeah, you know, the Common Engineering Criteria was a set of requirements that we asked every team at Microsoft that deliver a server workload to comply with. And we started this back in, it was either 2002 or 2003. And, you know, what the genesis of this was is, you know, we had all of these different servers and these workloads being delivered, whether that was, you know, the office workloads like SharePoint and Exchange and Link. You know, you had all the management with System Center, all the different workloads that exist inside a Windows server. And what was happening is all these workloads were being delivered to the market and they were inconsistent. You know, did they all support SysPrep? Did they all come with management packs that enable System Center to manage it? Were they all being deployed through MSI? You know, so all aspects of these workloads, we wanted to drive consistency across Microsoft so that when our customers, you know, get our workloads, they look the same, you know, in to where it makes sense. But more importantly, the underlying requirements that really are key are consistent. And we wanted to make this literally a promise to the world that said, listen, as we come out with our different servers and our different workloads, we want to drive a level of consistency across it. So we even published the Common Engineering Criteria. You know, I'm sure we can pop that up here for people to be able to see, but if you actually just go do a search for Microsoft Common Engineering Criteria, you will actually see what the Common Engineering Criteria is that we hold all the products to. And so then the way it actually works is, you know, here in the Windows Server organization, we're basically the keepers of the Common Engineering Criteria. And so we define those requirements, and every year we modify them and update them and add, remove, you know, whatever needs to be done. But then before any product can ship from Microsoft that has a server component, that product has to be reviewed, you know, by myself and by Bill Lang, who runs the developer discipline inside of Windows Server. And Bill really is the keeper of this. And literally every single server product has to come and give an accounting of their compliance with the Common Engineering Criteria. You know, so they come in, and if there's, you know, 40, 50, 60 different pieces of the criteria, they have to come and tell us, you know, where they're yellow at, where they're red at. And we're actually pretty stingy on granting variances. And so in most cases, if a team comes in and they said, we haven't got, you know, the following work done, they may be given a temporary type of reprieve, but there's usually a commitment on that that says, hey, within the next 90 days, we'll get this one addressed. So it's all about consistency, and it's all about delivering things in a way that makes it consistent for our customers.
Yeah, and that's such a great differentiator too, I think, in terms of the products that we have and how they work well together. They work the same, as you mentioned, where it makes sense. I mean, I think the most obvious example I think of whenever I think of the CEC is PowerShell. The fact that so many products and so many technologies now take advantage of PowerShell for all management configuration, and that's a true commonality among server and platform tools and tool sets. So very, very good.
I would definitely you know, recommend that everyone who's listening to this, just go do a search, go look at the Common Engineering Criteria, and you can literally see the criteria that we're holding everyone accountable to across Microsoft.
Fantastic. So let's talk about Linux.
Okay.
Why not? Now, why is it important for Microsoft to support for so long was a competitor to Microsoft in so many ways?
Well, you know, so the first thing I would say is, you know, we will do everything we can, and we will innovate like crazy, and you know, and we aspire to have every application ever built to be built on Windows. But we know that you know, despite us doing everything that we can, that there will be a bunch of applications that are built on non-Windows platforms. And if you think about what our goal is, you know, our goal is we want to be the cloud provider that every organization uses, whether that's in a private cloud model, or hosted, or public. And if you are going to be the underlying infrastructure and the architecture that clouds are built on, you have to support the operating systems and the workloads that customers want to run on the cloud. And so Linux is an absolute must-do there. And so as we think about this, you know, we take our desire to be your premier partner, you know, as I talk about customers, your partner for running you cloud capabilities. And along with that has to come a commitment that we'll do everything to make sure that Linux is a first-class citizen and runs well and is operable well, is resilient, is compliant, you know, all the things you would expect. We're going to do everything we can to make sure that Linux is a first-class citizen on our clouds.
And I think that's great. You know, certainly being able to support what our customers need on the platforms that we have and making them, as you say, first-class citizens. I think there's a number of examples around that. What specifically have we done to better support Linux in a virtualized workload, for example, on Hyper-V and Server 2012 R2?
Yeah, you know, so there's a number of things here, and there's things that we've done in the underlying, really at the hypervisor level itself, and then a bunch of things that we've done from a management perspective. So let me just give just some of the concepts of that. You know, one of the things that we've done is we have a set of capabilities that we call the Linux Integration Services. And think about this is, you know, the synthetic network and disk drivers that have to be in place for the hypervisor, as well as, you know, kind of like drivers do housekeeping things like time synchronization, shutdown, heartbeat. Those are all natively built into the different, first of all, built into the community. We build those here. We then contribute that to the community. And then all the different OS Linux vendors actually take that and actually include it as a part of their build. So whether you're looking at Red Hat or SUSE, you know, Ubuntu, CentOS, Oracle, Debian, you know, this work that we have done to build these drivers then gets distributed as a part of the various Linux distributions. But then, you know, the work that we do inside of our innovations in compute, storage, and networking, whether that be things like dynamic memory, which is actually one of the most interesting things that we've done in Hyper-V for a while. So this ability to dynamically be able to add or remove physical memory, hey, that applies to Linux just like it does to Windows.
I think some of the most
interesting things that we've done from an innovation standpoint is, if you look at the innovations in storage that we've done in 2012 and R2, in storage spaces and SMB 3.0, you know, we're delivering the capabilities that before you had to have fiber channel 4 and a SAN. We're doing that all now on direct attached storage, on JBODs, and we're able to drop the cost by more than 50% by doing that. That applies to Linux just like it does to Windows. And then there's a bunch of work that we've been doing in System Center for actually quite a while. You know, back in 2007, we announced that we were going to be adding capabilities to manage Linux through System Center, through Operations Manager. And now with these R2 releases, we've extended that just not from Operations Manager, but it's in Config Manager. It's been in Virtual Machine Manager for a while, but it's also in Data Protection Manager. So with Operations Manager, you can now monitor your applications, whether they're all Windows, whether they're all Linux, or a combination of Windows and Linux. You can manage that and monitor that all through Operations Manager. With Configuration Manager, you can get a hardware inventory, you can get a software inventory of the applications that have been deployed through System Center to Linux. You can get all the reporting on it, you can deploy all your software. So that's in Configuration Manager, support for Linux. And then with these R2 releases, we've also now added the ability for Data Protection Manager to now be able to back up your Linux application and your Linux operating system just like it does Windows. So it does it across the board. Now let me tell you an interesting kind of data point here. You know, when you install Microsoft software, one of the things it asks you for is it'll ask you, you know, hey, do you want to send telemetry back from Microsoft so we can kind of get an idea of what's being used? And we're grateful for everyone that approves on that. And so we get back an incredible amount of information that just kind of helps us understand where we should be innovating at, what's being used, those types of pieces, and kind of a lay of the land, if you will. One of the things that's been really, really rewarding to watch is since we released the Operations Manager support for Linux, just how broadly the support or the broadly the usage of System Center Operations Manager to monitor Linux is. You know, so the telemetry that we're getting back is, you know, close to 20% of all the organizations worldwide that are using Operations Manager and reporting back that they're using System Center to monitor their Linux application and their Linux OS. That's a huge number. That's a huge number. So I think we are monitoring more Linux than anybody in the world probably realizes. And we do it at a fraction of the price that other solutions do. And I think we've done pretty well here.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's really great. I love the example. I was at TechEd a number of weeks ago, and the discussion on backup of the Linux machine came up, and the fact that we can do a snapshot, essentially a freeze of the file system in Linux, so we can actually back up a live system. And that being a really big reason to virtualize your Linux workloads, because now if you put them in Hyper-V, you'll be able to take a live backup of a running machine without having to take it down. Amazing.
Yeah, you know, and you know, this ability that we have to be able to do things like, you know, that backup of a live system. You know, some of the innovations we did in Virtual Machine Manager, which, you know, I just realized I didn't touch on, is, You know, there are things that we can, that we've done now in Virtual Machine Manager, like the ability to quote unquote personalize your Linux deployment as you deploy it. So you can have one common Linux image, if you will, inside of our library, and then when you go to deploy it, we can do things like, you know, automatically put in some of the unique identity things, like the IP address, the name, those types of pieces, things that you would use, you know, kind of from a sysprep perspective on Windows. That's all possible through Virtual Machine Manager. So, you know, I think about the Fabric Controller. I think about things like software distribution that Config Manager has done, backup, monitoring, that whole stack. You know, we can deliver those capabilities now for Linux just like we do on Windows.
Fantastic. So let's talk a little bit about infrastructure as a service, IaaS. And one of the parts of your blog series has to do with innovations that we've made to support the data center, to support infrastructure as a service and your private cloud. What are some of the IaaS trends that you're seeing, and what's Microsoft doing to drive or to support and help encourage some of those trends?
Yeah, so maybe we can start with even kind of defining what infrastructure as a service is. You know, so as we talk about cloud computing, we talk about organizations standing up clouds. You know, what you're really doing is you're standing up a pool of capacity. That capacity is compute, storage, and networking. And then you give rights, whether it be to a line of business, to dev test. You know, you give the ability for organizations to come in and use those different pools of capacity. You can have variable, you know, rights and capabilities and privileges. But what you're doing is you're delivering an infrastructure as a service that then your customers, you know, whether those be internal or external, can utilize to start standing up their workloads and their applications, okay? So the first thing is, we talk about infrastructure as a service, let's make sure we don't kind of pigeonhole that to just public cloud. You know, service providers are delivering infrastructure as a service, and enterprises that are standing up these private clouds are also doing that. So the single biggest, you know, trends that we're seeing is just the move to cloud computing, which is a move to infrastructure as a service as a model. And then this move to consuming multiple clouds in a hybrid model, and those really are the key things that we're seeing.
Now, you mentioned service providers, and I think that's really interesting that we're building this for them also. And yes, certainly they would take advantage of a cloud environment the same as any enterprise would in their own private cloud in their own data centers. But why, maybe beyond that, would this be an attractive option for service providers to give to their customers?
Yeah, so there's a couple of points here that I think are interesting for us to touch on. You know, first of all, as we talk about and use kind of the term service providers, you know, obviously this, it applies to you know, organizations that are standing up data centers and have capacity that they are then reselling to organizations around the world. But I would submit that just about every organization in the world, every enterprise, is also a service provider. They're providing services to their customers, which are largely internal, you know, to the line of business, to the dev and test that are in there. So when I talk about service providers, I want to make sure that the world understands, you know, I'm talking about enterprises and hosters, okay, as service providers. And I think in this move to the cloud, organizations are also, going through a change where they're moving much more into a service provider kind of model, okay? Now, there's a couple of reasons why we think this is important. You know, first of all, in this hybrid computing model, the number of organizations that are utilizing capacity coming from service providers is just growing, you know, rapidly. And in fact, as we actually do our research on this, close to 10% of all the x86 servers that were sold worldwide in the last 12 months were purchased by service providers. So it's a significant pool of capacity that's out there. And so with that in mind, we said, listen, we want to deliver capabilities that enable organizations to be able to deliver an infrastructure as a service set of capabilities. And we want to enable them to deliver highly available, highly reliable services and infrastructure as a service at an economical model that we believe gives them the lowest cost model in the market. And so with that in mind, you know, we've done a lot of innovations down low in the operating system, in storage, in compute, and in networking. And then we've done a lot of innovation up on top, if you will, of the operating system in terms of like things that we're doing for the service provider, for a self-service portal, the ability then for them to be able to look at usage, and the ability then for them to be able to create services that they can then offer to their customers that allow them to advance their business. We've been doing all of those. So maybe we can even kind of like maybe dive into some of the low-lying innovations to start with.
So I think one of the most interesting things to me is some of the improvements and new technologies we've provided around storage. Can you talk about some of those?
Yeah, you know, I look at the innovation that we started in storage in 2012, and that what we've added on that in the R2 releases, and it really is quite phenomenal, the capabilities that we now enable on really, you know, you could call it commodity, cost-effective hardware, whatever term you want to use. But for all too long, I think that some of the highly available, highly reliable assets that the world has really sought after for has required significant expenditures, you know, on fiber channel and on SANs. And I think there's just a way that can be delivered in a much more cost-effective manner. And just to be super clear here, we love SANs, and, you know, we fully support SANs. So I don't want anybody to walk away that say, hey, Windows Server and System Center aren't supportive of SANs. We absolutely are. But as we take a look at the cost in the data center, and you take a look at the cost in compute and storage and network and people, storage is actually one of the fastest growing costs, and it actually is one of the biggest buckets of costs in the data center. And as we look at what we do from a cloud perspective on how we run Bing and how we run Azure and on all these services, we're doing all of that on direct attached storage on JBODs. And so there's a lot of innovation that we've done in the public cloud that we've now brought to organizations to run in their data centers. And so getting a little bit specific there, you know, as we really set off on the R2 path, we asked ourselves the question, hey, what can we do to reduce the cost per gigabyte, as well as what can we do to reduce the cost per IOP per gigabyte in the private cloud? And they're different. Okay, so we've done work that decreases the cost, and then we've also done work that significantly increases the number of IOPs, and that's the input and output per second that you can get on the same hardware. Okay, so let's just talk about some of those specifics. So some of the things specifically that we've done is in SMB, okay? So we've done a lot of work in SMB and SMB Direct. And think about this is, you know, with these RDMA-enabled network cards, we can just achieve amazing performance, amazing capabilities with commodity hardware, but leveraging the RDMA capabilities. So, for example, some of the things that we demonstrated at TechEd was the ability to live migrate VMs between servers using SMB in just a fraction of the time that it required, even in 2012. I mean, the enhance we did there were remarkable. You know, we've done work in things like what we call storage spaces tiering. So now the ability to be able to use a combination of SSDs and just, you know, traditional hard drives, and make sure that your hot blocks of data or the hot areas are all being serviced from an SSD. And in doing that, the performance, the number of IOPS we're getting is remarkable. And so if you go take a look, for example, at the TechEd keynotes, whether you look at the one from North America or from Europe in Madrid, at the very end there, you'll see Jeff Woolsey come on stage and show some demonstrations of the performance with a system that's, you know, based on built on, you know, roughly 30 hard drives and 4 SSDs. And so, you know, with just a very, very small number of SSDs, you know, we're seeing 15, 16, 20x increases in their performance using this, you know, the storage spaces tiering that we developed in the R2 capability. So just remarkable what we can do. You know, and then we've literally, you know, there's things like with those SSDs, you know, we can now report back a commit to the application once the write has been committed into the SSD, then we actually do it onto the actual, you know, hard disk itself later. And as well as we did some pretty remarkable work in dedupe and in deduplication, you know, and we're able to do this just not in the footprint, but actually in how we actually use the capability. So I think the best example of this that I've seen, again, referring back to that TechEd keynote at the very end there, is we actually show not only the footprint saving, but we also show the performance saving that comes from dedupe in a VDI environment where we're showing a 90% plus savings in the footprint. But then we actually compare how long it takes to bring up a bunch of VDI sessions in a deduped environment with your 2012 R2 versus a non-dedupe. And what you see is it actually is up many, many times faster to actually boot those VDI sessions in that dedupe environment than it was before. So storage, I think, is the place that we did the most innovation in 2012 and 2012 R2 in terms of really bringing down costs and dramatically increasing performance.
And a lot of this, as you mentioned, is being built based on a knowledge, as Microsoft's knowledge, and being an expert at providing as a foundation for private and hosted cloud environments because of our history running data centers and acting as a global cloud provider in things such as Azure and Office 365. So that knowledge really has been applied to R2 and these products. Let's talk about a couple of other there. You talked pretty deeply about storage. I know we might want to talk about compute and networking, because those are two other areas that there's been some improvements. Let's talk about networking and improvements in Server R2 around areas. Oh, I don't know. There's an acronym, SDN, that we might want to talk about.
Yeah, kind of a lot of conversation about that, right?
Yeah.
You know, so maybe we can start there from a networking piece. You know, as you think about clouds, and one of the things that clouds promises is the ability to dynamically deploy and the ability to dynamically move workloads and VMs. You know, when you really click down on what that means, you know, if you're moving VMs across clouds, if you're even moving VMs across servers, even across racks in your own data center, what has to happen in order to, you know, remap the network? Do you have to go create new VLANs? Do you have to, you know, associate VLANs, those types of pieces? To give you an idea, inside of Azure, every single day we make more than 50,000 networking changes. That have, and it's got to be automated. It's got to be automated in a way that is tied to, associated with the application or the VM, so that when you move a VM or you move an application, everything moves with it. And so as we think about the work that we've done in networking, we could spend a half an hour just on what we've done from a software-defined networking standpoint. You know, there's a bunch of work that we've done in what we call the Hyper-V virtual switch and what we call Hyper-V network virtualization. And what it really comes down to is giving you the ability to be able to express policy and have that policy then travel with and automatically be applied in the dynamic nature of what a cloud provides. And so, you know, you can now live migrate across across layer two networks, and all the networking settings follow it. You can bring your own topology with you. You know, so from in the BYO environment, you can bring your own IP address, and we have the ability to actually be able to enable that and have the IP address management all taken care of for you. And so, you know, what I would encourage everyone to do here is, you know, there literally is just an incredible amount of information to look at here, but with R2, with Windows Server R2 and with Virtual Machine Manager R2, one of the components of System Center, you have a complete end-to-end network management solution that's now natively built in. You know, everything from the gateways that are required, everything from network access, translation, the forwarding function, all that is just now natively built into Windows Server. And of course, we've got great partners like, you know, F5 and Huawei and Iron Networks who enhance and extend that. But natively in the box, you have a complete solution that allows you to be able to manage all of your network in a virtualized or cloud setting. There's capabilities in there to actually do some of the basic management of your physical networking devices. And then the ability to actually have gateways that allows you to cross from virtual to physical to virtual and have that capability just natively built into Windows and into System Centers that's now natively in the R2 releases. So it's pretty remarkable.
It is. That's the ultimate portability, when you can move a virtual machine from here to here to here, if you want to go up to the public cloud. And in all cases, that IP address for that machine doesn't have to change, because it's a whole virtual, it's another virtual layer, but it's network virtualization. And as you say, supporting the hardware that supports it, the NVGRE protocol that our partners are providing in their hardware, as well as providing our own provider in software and driving it through Virtual Machine Manager, all very powerful. So very exciting.
You know, and then some of the work that we've done in OMI, to where, you know, using PowerShell now, you can actually be able to manage and be able to orchestrate change through PowerShell across all these devices, I think is pretty cool as well.
Mm. So let's move on and talk about the end user experience. And by the end user, I'm really talking about both the user of a service in an infrastructure as a service environment, and also the service provider, because of course they're an end user in terms of they're working with the foundation. So even at a higher level than the infrastructure in the data center, let's talk about that layer. And we've made a lot of improvements. That, you know, a lot of things that the data centers and service providers can take advantage of. But we have these two audiences. Talk a little bit more about those.
Yeah, you know, as we define our products and we do all the work in terms of scenarios and spec all that out, we spend a lot of time thinking about who the exact persona is going to be in the customer, in the organization that's going to be using the capabilities. And we spend a lot of time really trying to deeply understand the motivations, the demands that are being placed upon them, and how they all interoperate. So as we think about a service provider and an enterprise that's acting like a service provider, we really think about three different personas. Okay, we think about the individual who is the fabric controller, you know, the individual that stands up the cloud is responsible for operating the underlying infrastructure of the cloud, and really kind of is all about the fabric and enabling that. And so there's a set of work that we do there. But then we think about there's roles inside of service providers and organizations that then define the services that the actual customers are going to be able to use. And that might be, you know, defining here's a deployment of Exchange, or here's a deployment of SharePoint, or here's different size web servers you can use. But they actually create offers or services that can then be purchased or used by the customers. And then the customers, we actually talk about them being the tenants. So in a service provider, you've got, you know, the service provider delivering capabilities to multiple tenants. Inside of an enterprise, those tenants could be the different lines of business. It could be dev, test, but they are the consumers of the cloud. So there's the creator of the cloud. There's the creator of the offers or the services that then get delivered to the actual tenants, okay? And in this R2 release, we really put a lot of our focus on the two personas, the tenant and the persona that is the service creator or the offer creator. And what we did here is we took the innovation that we had been driving and had been using in Windows Azure itself, that actual portal console experience, and brought that on top of Windows Server and System Center through what we call the Windows Azure Pack. So now organizations have the exact same experience that, that customers get, that tenants get when they come up to use Azure capability. They have that now for the service provider, okay, and for the tenant. One thing to point out here is we hear from many of our service providers that they like to roll their own consoles, and that's perfectly fine as well. There's a REST API that gives access to all of this. And so, you know, we do deliver you a very rich self-service experience that you can use for your tenants or for your customers, but also the APIs exist there that allow you to roll your own. So there's that beautiful experience. I think it really is a nice, very well-designed and very usable experience you can use.
Yes, I agree. I was actually going to, that was going to be my next question, is we have this new, exciting user interface that's not really new. It's a familiar experience to those of us who have worked with Windows Azure in the public cloud, but now providing this thing called the Windows Azure Pack.
You know, and our, one of our biggest promises to the industry is about delivering consistency across clouds. Mm-hmm. And I know I talk about this a lot, but it really is hard, I think, to overstate just how important this is. If you have consistency for developers, consistency for IT professionals, consistency for the actual teams and individuals and customers that are consuming the cloud capacity, life is just so much easier. You know, and I think the litmus test and the benchmark here is, can an application be developed and that application then be deployed and utilized across clouds without having to change any tools, any processes? It just works. And that's the litmus test we're trying to hold ourselves to. And it's really interesting. I think when we first came out with Azure, a lot of organizations asked themselves, hey, is Azure trying to compete with us? And we said, listen, we're going to innovate in Azure, but we're going to deliver those innovations to you to run in your data center, whether you're an enterprise or whether a service provider. And I think what we're talking about here in terms of some of these innovations that we're delivering, like the experience, like the ability to do high-density web server hosting, is really proof on that promise and on the delivery of that promise that we're going to innovate rapidly in the cloud, but we're also in the public cloud, but we're going to bring all that innovation to our partners and customers around the world to utilize as well. And so, you know, it's one of those pieces where, you know, you'll see me continue to talk about consistency across clouds. And the reason you'll see me do that is I think it's impossible to overstate how important that is. Okay. Now, the other piece that I think is important to point out here is, you know, ultimately, whether you're a service provider or whether you are an enterprise, you know, you actually want to track usage. In an enterprise, it might be you just want to track usage to be able to report back, you know, or show back. In a service provider, you know, this really is, you know, core to the business, because you have to be able to watch and be able to report on usage and then bill back, okay? And so we've done a lot of work in terms of the billing infrastructure that's been built natively into Windows Server and System Center, those chargeback scenarios. So there's a usage metering system in R2. It gives you a set of very nice reports that you can use in Excel, and you can actually kind of do what-if scenarios in kind of Excel with the capabilities. There's a set of dashboards that come that can be used within SharePoint. But you literally can get down, for example, in a compute model to where you can actually track the usage on a per-hourly basis, use that to then bill back, to show back. And there's a lot of great work in there that people should look at. The other really interesting thing here is, and this is kind of a crazy thing to talk about, but from a service providers participate in a licensing model from Microsoft called SPLA, the Service Provider License Agreement. And You know, as stupid as this sounds, you know, it wasn't really easy for service providers to get usage information to report back to us for them to, you know, easily be able to understand how much did they owe Microsoft, okay? So there's a bunch of work that we've also done in there to make it easy to actually get accurate and simple reporting on usage from a SLA perspective, because, you know, every organization wants to be compliant with their with their partners and with their vendors, and so we just made that dramatically more simple.
I thought it was actually very interesting how easy it is to configure a virtual machine and, as a role, build kind of a template that can be scaled out and scaled back. So very much like you had in the platform as a service arena in Windows Azure, we have these scalable web services and websites and virtual machines that we can very easily then at a later point scale up and scale back. And making that available not only to, you know, through Windows Azure certainly, but also the Azure Pack, which can be taken advantage of by your own enterprise as well as service providers. So very, very powerful stuff.
Yeah, for people who go look at the blog, you'll actually see side-by-side comparisons of what the screenshots look like for someone who's using, you know, Azure, and then someone who's using Windows Server and System Center in their enterprise or the service provider. And you can see the experience is consistent. It's pretty darn close to identical. And it just, that cloud consistency, the ability to use the cloud that is most appropriate and best for you, that really is what's key here, and enabling that friction-free movement across clouds and that friction-free experience for the IT pro and for the developer of being able to develop an application and then deploy that application in the cloud that makes the most sense for them.
Now, we've talked about Azure Pack a couple of times, but what do I need to buy or what does it require if I am an enterprise and I have Server 2012 R2, System Center 2012 R2? What else do I need to make the Azure Pack a reality?
That's it. Just download the Azure Pack from the web. You know, so the Azure Pack is just a free download from the web. It installs on top of Windows Server and System Center. The integration has been done with System Center and with Windows Server. And so as you think about what the cloud platform is for Microsoft, it's Windows Server, it's System Center, and it's the Windows Azure Pack. And that Windows Azure Pack, I think, is just such a wonderful example of where Microsoft is bringing the innovation from the public cloud down to the private and hosted clouds.
Fantastic. Now, of course, with all of this comes the topic of identity and the problem of how do we address managing users, managing their accounts, and then applying security, applying policy, authentication and authorization. So let's talk a little bit about identity management. If I already have users that are already represented in my Active Directory, what are the implications of using cloud-based services?
So let's talk a little bit about hybrid IT and some of these promises of the cloud OS and identity. You know, so I talked about these four key trends at the beginning of the conversation. And you know, as we talk about the Microsoft Cloud OS, we think we're delivering promises that enable you to transform your data center, to deliver what we call people-centric IT and embrace the consumerization of IT and to get insights from all your data. Well, if you think about it, underlying all of these promises and the ability to be able to execute on, you've got to have an identity solution that allows you to be able to grant access and then monitor access and manage access on these core company assets. So as we think about the promise of the cloud, identity is an absolute foundational requirement that you have to have. Okay. Now, as you think about identity, enterprises have used Active Directory as the primary source of enterprise identity for the last decade. You know, we introduced Active Directory with Windows 2000, and now, you know, 90, 95% plus of the organizations around the world use Active Directory as the authoritative source for identity. But now as you start to think about stretching the boundaries of your data center to a service provider, stretching the boundaries of your data center to Azure, starting to utilize SaaS-based applications from vendors around the world, you know, the question you have to ask is, what's going to be my identity management solution and how am I going to manage access and authorize access to make sure that the right people have access to the right data at the right time in that world where everything's just not running in my data centers any longer? And that's Active Directory again. But the way to think about this is we have cloud-optimized Active Directory. We've extended Active Directory to the cloud with Azure Active Directory. So just like we've done, and we talked about this in the previous conversation, you know, we have now extended the reach of Active Directory out into the cloud by integrating Azure Active Directory and Active Directory in one. And the way, you know, people should think about this is as a continuum. And so, you know, one of the pieces of work that we did in the R2 release is we dramatically simplified the deployment of what we call Active Directory Federation services. And that's the piece that allows you to basically do this integration between your on-premise Active Directory and Azure Active Directory. You know, so it's much, much easier to deploy, get up and running. And then from that point, you know, when the IT professional sets it up, they are in complete control of what capabilities they want or what attributes and what objects they want to have appear in Azure Active Directory and replicate it from their on-premises Active Directory. So many organizations may be asking themselves, well, you know, hey, I don't know that I want to put the actual identities and passwords of my users up into Azure. Fine. You know, you can just have the links, if you will, and you can still use Azure Active Directory to authenticate to our services and provide things like single sign-on to other SaaS-based applications. But the actual authentication passes through Azure Active Directory, and the authentication actually occurs against your local Active Directory in that kind of environment. But the key thing here is the IT professionals around the world are in complete control of what they decide to synchronize between Active Directory and Azure Active Directory. So there's a couple of pieces on a blog we just barely posted about some of the innovation that we did in Azure Active Directory. I just want to point out a couple of them. Okay, first I talked about the work that we did to dramatically simplify Active Directory Federated Services and the deployment of it. But there's some great work that we're also doing now that allows you to do things like single sign-on to some to third-party SaaS-based applications. And like Salesforce is a great example. You know, one of the great benefits that I think Active Directory has provided for years is a user can come in, authenticate themselves to their device that automatically authenticates them to Active Directory. Then they go to access their corporate line of business applications. It's all single sign-on. The user's got a great experience. Okay, with some of the new capabilities that we're coming out with, you now have that ability to also do that for third-party SaaS-based applications, and we've done that work. On top of Azure Active Directory, there's also an API that allows anybody in the world to integrate with and take advantage of the identities that sit there. The other piece I think is really important to point out here, which has a link back to the consumerization of IT, is we've done work inside of the R2 release in Active Directory and Azure Active Directory that we call a workplace join. Okay. For a long, long time, organizations have required domain joined devices in order to be able to access corporate resources. I mean, that's one of the ways that they enforce policy, security, power on password, those types of pieces. Well, in this modern world of bring your own device, domain join really isn't an option for some of the devices. You know, if you think about an Apple device or you think about an Android device, even an RT device, there's not domain join capabilities native in the system. So what we thought about here is we said, hey, in this new world of bring your own device, how do we enable users to be able to register their devices with Active Directory so that IT professionals can set policy, you know, for access from those devices and understand which devices belong to which users? And we came up with this concept that we call workplace join. So what workplace join enables is a user on their device, and this can be on a Windows device, on an iOS device, on an Android device, can come up, they register their device with Active Directory or Azure Active Directory. It then creates an object for that device inside of the directory and downloads a certificate down to the device itself. Now, that device can identify itself to Active Directory. IT can put some lightweight policies on that, like, you know, requiring a power on password. You can kind of think about it as kind of an EAS++ kind of a model. But, you know, in our vision, we want to be able to enable organizations to express access policy based on the user, on the device they're working from, and then the network location. So now with this concept of workplace join, or users have the ability to identify or register their personal devices with Active Directory so that policy can be placed and enable them to access corporate resources even from their personal devices. Pretty cool capabilities.
And globally accessible because we're using services like Windows Azure Active Directory as that focal globally available point from which anyone anywhere can use to gain access and gain authentication.
No, you're 100% right.
Wow, that's amazing, and amazing that we're supporting so many different devices and non Microsoft devices in this world of this workplace join and this kind of an in between. Fully domain joined and not managed at all. I think it's just wonderful.
Yeah, and I would even add on to that. I think it's remarkable how much innovation we were able to deliver in these R2 releases. You know, in a 1 year release cycle. You know, I've talked about this on the blog about some of the changes we made in our tools and our processes, how we're using our cloud first design principles, and those are the things that are enabling us to come up with this amount of innovation and this, you know, this incredible innovation in such a short period of time.
And you already mentioned it, but I just wanted to maybe point and refer to it again, how interesting it is that we are now supporting authentication in the cloud for services that are non-Microsoft related. So the fact that you can do a authentication to a Salesforce.com or some other cloud-based service, and use Active Directory as the authentication point, the same tool that we're still are currently using, and as you said, many, 95% of businesses are using today, can use that as their single sign-on, their single source of identity for their users.
Yeah, certainly all of our services that we're building are keying off this as well. So Office 365 authenticates against Azure Active Directory. Windows Intune authenticates against Active Directory. Azure does. And so as you see more and more of the services come out from Microsoft, you know that they will all authenticate against Azure Active Directory.
So in the time we have left, just if you could touch a little bit about on some of the options for getting this configured, the single sign-on, for example, using Active Directory, using ADFS to Windows Azure Active Directory.
Yeah, you know, so I think in terms of how to actually get it deployed, what I would encourage people to do is go read the latest blog. In that latest blog, we actually go screen by screen by screen how you actually go and get that set up, and you'll see how that actually is done through the same kind of experience we just talked about in terms of that self-service portal. In that blog as well, it then also then links off onto a number of in-depth blogs from the identity team here that goes into a pretty incredible amount of detail that we've done. I think the biggest thing that I would just encourage people to do is, you know, one, make sure that you've read through the blogs. Okay, you know, the whole intent of doing these blogs is to help everyone come up to speed on just the innovation that's there. Two, I would actually encourage people to take a look at the keynotes we've done in the most recent events. So go take a look at the keynotes from TechEd. Go take a look at the keynotes if you're a developer, what we did at Build. You know, in those, you get a chance to see some pretty intensive demonstrations of the capabilities live. And one of the things that I thought was that I was incredibly proud of in a number of these events was every one of the demos that we did had a connection to Azure, and so we were doing these live, you know, across these links. And then the third thing I would say is get a hold of and download the previews. So download the preview of Windows Server 2012 R2 and of System Center, and actually, you know, go out and try these capabilities. We're making great progress in terms of finishing them up right now.
Well, that's a really great way to wrap up our talk today, talking about those resources, encouraging people to try the products, to view the resources, to view the online recordings. We certainly want to make sure that people understand where your blog is. So it's just blogs.technet.com/in-the-cloud. We'll bring you right to Brad's blog on all these topics. And I understand you also have a Twitter account that you'd like to promote and have people follow you there.
It's just at in-the-cloud-msft.
In the cloud, MSFT. All right. We'll definitely follow you there. Well, Mr. Anderson, thank you so much again for your time today. Really appreciate it.
All right, Kevin.
And we'll see you all again soon for part 3 of TechNet Radio, What's New in Server 2012 R2.